Ah, so it's November 1st. We can officially start thinking about turkeys. I will accept it now, guys.
Wait, there's a holiday about turkeys? I thought Christmas was the next holiday.
No.
That's what the mainstream media would have you believe.
At least if you're in the U.S., there's another holiday. I mean, it's still kind of like contested because obviously settling Americans did horrible things.
Yeah.
But I just like the food. Exactly. We do use it as a great holiday to get around the table and, you know, share our friendships and stuff. Like, I mean, I honestly love doing Friendsgiving. I think that's really fun. I love not having to host it. I love it when someone else does.
Right. But I am doing something for Thanksgiving. I have a family down, well, in Alabama, so down in this area, that the last time I was stationed here, which was 2012, I met these two people at an anime convention. And the girl, so they're a couple and they're married now. In fact, that's the wedding that I went to back in July was their wedding. But the girl, her family kind of like adopted me while I was living down here because they were like, we know that you can't always go up to your family for every holiday. And we're a lot closer. You know, they're about like a 6-hour drive away. So about the distance from Sacramento to Los Angeles, you know. So they were like, you're welcome to come here for any holiday. So I went there for Thanksgiving in 2012. And now that I'm back here, they're like, well, you better be coming for Thanksgiving this year.
But, you know, I have one question, though. I mean, because you're kind of like a house elf. Do they have to give you a piece of clothing for you to leave?
Oh, no, it's nothing like that. But yeah, so that's what I'm doing for Thanksgiving. I'm spending it with my Alabama surrogate family.
Nice.
Because I can't be with my blood family up in South Dakota.
That's nice. That'll be pleasant. So, we never do turkey. I'm not really a turkey fan. But I mean, I'll eat it. Like, I mean, it's not like I'm not a monster, but
turkey.
I'm not like the type that's like gonna sit over and slave over the turkey. I'd rather make myself like a crab leg or, you know,
like
go get some sushi or something. Yeah. You know, it's be grateful. Don't be stressed out.
Right. That's true.
But yeah.
Since it's November 1st, we just celebrated Halloween. So
we did.
So also welcome back to everybody who suffered through our last episode.
Yeah, thank you. And if you didn't, then I'm glad you skipped.
I hope you listened, that you're still here. No. And if you are still here, thank you. If you skipped it, hi, we're back to our regular scheduled programming.
That's why it's a bonus. It's it's like a pop. Well, although pop quizzes are mandatory, you know, we had producer Ian and I had our Halloween party last weekend and it was super fun. Everybody had a blast. We got to like 2:30 in the morning. We're like, guys, you're talking like outdoor voices outside. It's 2:30.
Yeah.
Like Ian has to go to work by like 7.
Oh, God. Yeah. Because
we love you guys, but get out.
See, at least my church doesn't start until 10:15. So it's like, even if I stay up late, I can still make it to church in the morning because it's at 10:15.
Exactly.
But so my Halloween party is actually tomorrow when this comes out. So because this comes out on the 1st and my Halloween party is on the 2nd. So my party is still in the future, even for me right now. And it will still be in the future for you guys when you're listening. So my Halloween party, well, at least if you're listening on or before November 1st. So it's this weekend and I'm excited. It's going to be Harry Potter themed. So every year I host a themed Halloween party. That's kind of my thing. And this year's theme, originally it was going to be Promtober and it was going to be everybody comes like formal prom wear. And then I decided I don't want to do that. Maybe next year. I don't know. Yeah. But so I changed my mind like about like 2 months ago and was like, I want to do a Harry Potter themed one. So,
nice.
You know, it's going to be really cool. I've got stuff figured out. And it's going to be kind of like my unofficial housewarming party.
Because, very cool. You know, very cool. Wish I could go, but I'll be over here in California.
Well, you'll get to see my house at some point, and I finally have a couch we can all sit on. So,
yay! I saw a nice couch.
I only had to wait 27 days for that couch to get delivered.
Nice.
Like I ordered it October 2nd, and it came
3 weeks later.
October 29th. It was ridiculous. God. But anyway, but it's here and I love it and it's great.
Yay! Great napping couch. It's a great looking napping couch.
It's huge. It's a sectional. So it's like an L-shaped couch and it's big enough for two people to sleep on. Like it's a big couch. I forgot how big it was.
You're just like, oh my gosh, this looked like smaller in the store.
It did, though. Well, but that's the problem with like looking at furniture in the store is it's surrounded by so much other furniture.
It looks smaller.
Where it's like,
that's a good point.
My whole house is an open floor plan. So putting like a giant sectional couch in it, it fills it up. And it's like, oh my God, this couch is ginormous. It's huge. It actually, you know, frames off my living room finally. So
yay.
But yeah, so
boundaries.
I know. So that's what we've been up to. Let us know on like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram what you guys have been up to for Halloween. Yeah. We want to see
interact with us.
We want to see your Halloween costumes.
Yes, we do.
Send us your Halloween costumes. We'll make like a post on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah.
We can't really make a post. We can make a story post on Instagram and you send us like reply to the story with like your Halloween costumes and we'll repost them to our story.
Absolutely.
But we want to see your Halloween costumes from this year.
No matter what time of the year you listen to this.
Yes.
Please send us your Halloween costume.
Actually, yes. If it's like, you know, January 2019 or 2020. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
January 2020. You're listening to this episode and you're like, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't share it. Share it. We want to see it. We'll still post it. We'll be like, this is, you know, coming in like 3 months late. But here's so-and-so's Halloween costume.
Yay. So that'd be really fun. So, yeah, please send us your Halloween costumes. You can also send it to conspiriesencryptids@gmail.com.
Yes, you can.
Shall we talk about some conspiracies and cryptids?
We shall. Yeah. I changed my topic this week very last minute.
Oh.
I was going to talk about a cryptid known as the Mantis Man.
Oh.
But
that sounds like fun.
It was, but I was thinking to myself, I was like, I've talked about a lot of these obscure cryptids this season, so maybe it's time to bring up one that's a little bit more well known. So
yeah.
Yeah, so when we get to my part, I'll tell you guys about an interesting one. So.
Sweet. I know you like I love how like cryptids tend to be like creepy insect plus man.
Yeah.
Like Mantis Man. Mothman.
Well, there's just a lot
Fly
of
man.
There's a lot of blank man. You know, there's a lot of cryptid man. So there's Mothman, Owlman.
True.
Mantis Man, Lizard Man from like last episode. It's a very male dominated society apparently of cryptids.
Step it up, ladies. Like La Llorona, come on.
Oh God, like, La Llorona would be a good one to talk about. Maybe next Halloween.
Maybe. No, it's a good idea. So we're ready to shake a penny for our thoughts right?
Yep.
So that we find out who is going to go first. So we shake up the penny for your thoughts.
If you guys don't already know,
Sammy covers cryptids. I cover conspiracies usually, unless we decide to shake it up. Whose turn is it?
It's my turn this time.
Okay. And tell me when to stop and tell me when to go and tell me what you want.
I'm picking heads.
Okay. Heads. Go
nice.
For it.
Okay. So like I said, I changed up my cryptid literally yesterday.
Oh.
So we were supposed to record yesterday, and I was like, like Sunday night, I was like, I'm changing my cryptid. And then I was like, well, I guess Monday I'm going to write this script really fast. So I wrote it between like yesterday and today, but I finished
it. Perfect. So did I.
Like I said, I talked about a lot of obscure cryptids recently, and I was like, first of all, I haven't talked about like a more popular one. And second of all, I haven't talked about a lake monster this season.
Mm.
And since I would say over 50% of cryptids on the cryptid list are lake monsters, I realized I should probably be dispersing these out throughout the seasons so that when we're like in season 9, I don't have like 12 episodes of lake monsters in a row.
Entire season of lake monsters.
So I was like, I should probably start, you know, spreading these out a little bit and at least including one or two a season. But,
good plan.
So this week we're going to be talking about a lake monster whose fame is up there with Nessie's, but surprisingly doesn't have a Nessie adjacent name. So a lot of lake monsters just tend to follow Nessie in the vein of an Essie name. Like there's Tessie and Bessie, you know, and just all sorts of Essie names. This one surprisingly doesn't. This one has, it's one of the most well-recorded and well-documented lake monsters outside of the Loch Ness Monster, with over 600 and counting sightings. Yeah, 600 and counted. Come on, English. You're my first language. 600 and counting sightings.
You'll get there.
So this monster hails from the shores of Lake Champlain, which is right on the borders of New York, Vermont, and Quebec. It's a lake that spans about 125 square miles. So it's a big lake.
Oh, wow.
It's a big lake.
Holy cow.
And this this cryptid is lovingly referred to as Champ.
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 Champ. I like it.
Champ is really cool.
Champ. Champ.
Okay. So description of what Champ is. He or it, they range from 10 to 187 feet long, depending on the sighting.
Whoa.
The head is either flat or rounded and horse-like, with sometimes three long teeth and then sometimes like an alligator-like mouthful of teeth. It has eyes the color of a peeled onion, which is kind of gross looking. One account said that it had a white star on its forehead and a red ring or band around its neck. Its body is as thick as a barrel and has 1 to 4 humps. It has fins and a snake-like body. And then the skin is either scaly or smooth. It just kind of depends on the sightings.
Yeah.
In fact, some researchers have said that they actually think that this isn't one creature, that it actually might be a kind of family pod of anywhere from 10 to 20 of these creatures breeding. Mm. And that's why there's such a variety in sizes and colors and stuff like that, because there might be young ones and older ones and stuff like that.
Plenty of places to hide in a 125 square mile lake.
Yeah. So legends of this creature actually date back to the two Native American tribes that lived in the region prior to European settlers. The two Native American tribes are the Iroquois and the Abenaki, which I've never heard of the Abenaki tribes before. Maybe it's a Canadian tribe, but I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that. They both have legends of a serpent-like creature living in the depths of Lake Champlain. And the name for the Abenaki's creature is specifically the Tatoskok. So, and that, like I said, that dates back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years.
Cool.
So the first European sighting comes from 1609. Legends claim that Samuel de Champlain, a French cartographer and the namesake of the lake, was the first European to see Champ back in 1609. But it's come to light that the quote of him saying that he saw a 20-foot serpent thick as a barrel and head like a horse was a fake quote published in a 1970 issue of Vermont Life, and was actually a misquote of some very large fish he saw along the coast of St. Lawrence Estuary, which is like a river, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Not Lake Champlain at all.
Interesting.
However, he did see Champ that year when he finally discovered, and I used the word discovered lightly, when he finally discovered the lake.
New to him.
So the first quote was misquoted as Champ, but it wasn't. But he did see Champ, and what he claimed to have seen at Lake Champlain was an unknown animal, 11 to 12 meters long and about 30 centimeters in diameter, dark mahogany in color, almost black, looking like a giant snake. So that was the actual quote of what he saw at Lake Champlain. The next sighting comes like over 200 years later in July of 1819. A man named Captain Crumb, like kind of like Captain Crunch.
Crummy. That's a crummy last name.
It's a crummy last name. Captain Crumb reported that on the previous Thursday, when he'd been out on Bulwaga Bay, he'd seen a creature 200 yards away that was 187 feet long, rear its seahorse-like head 15 feet out of the water. Just the head. The body didn't come 15 feet out of the water. Like a head and a neck came 15 feet out of the water. I always do like hand motions, like you guys can see me, but it's like I'm making like a snake like motion with my hand. So despite it being so far away, I mean, 200 yards away, that's not close. But despite it being so far away, he claimed to notice minute details such as having three teeth, eyes the color of a peeled onion, and a white star in its forehead and a belt of red around its neck. So,
ooh.
But I mean, Regardless, though, 200 yards away, you're going to notice a 15-foot neck come out of the water.
Can you imagine, like, just hanging out at Tahoe, and then just all of a sudden this just, like, beast just comes out of the water, like, in 2019? You're just like, am I seeing what I'm seeing?
On the one hand, I would be absolutely, like, enraptured and excited, but on the, and, like, just so thrilled that I finally get to see a cryptid. On the other hand, I would be absolutely freaking terrified.
Right?
Like, this, like, giant dinosaur creature just pulled its head out of the water where I am currently floating in a boat.
Your reality just, like, upside down if your boat isn't. Like, holy cow. Yeah.
So, no, it's like, I would prefer to see any sort of cryptid from the safety of, like, well, at least a lake monster from the safety of shore.
Very far away.
Where, you know, hopefully it's not going to come up on the land and, you know, bite my face off. But
exactly.
So the next sighting came from, or came about, like, 50 years later in July of 1870. It's every single passenger aboard a steamship excursion around the lake claimed to have seen a mysterious monster near Charlotte, the Charlotte, Vermont side of the lake. Every passenger on the boat.
Wow.
Yeah. Every story corroborated, even when they weren't talking to each other, when they all, like, pulled them aside and stuff like that, every single passenger, their stories
was like, I saw this. Wow. Yeah. Ooh.
So now I didn't get an exact number on how many passengers there were, but it was still enough for it to pop up in, like, a list of sightings. 1873 was a busy year for Champ. The New York Times ran a story about a crew of railroad workers that saw a serpent-like creature with silvery scales in the lake. Apparently, as they were working on the railroad, they, you know, saw this snake-like thing come up out of the water and had silver scales.
Hey, what you doing?
And they quickly ran off and told people about it.
You got about tree fitty?
Got about tree fitty? Later that same year in July, Clinton County Sheriff Nathan Mooney claimed to have seen an enormous snake or water serpent that was 25 to 35 feet long. The next month in August, a steamship named the W.B. Eddy, which I love that. W.B. Eddy.
W.B. Eddy. Sounds like a DJ name.
Right? Instead of, like, DJ Khaled, it's W.B. Eddy.
W.B. Eddy.
Featuring W.B. Eddy. Okay, so the W.B. Eddy almost capsized because it ran into Champ.
Oh, right? Oh, God.
The passengers and crew all saw a large creature swim out of sight immediately after running into this lump. So it's not like it was a rock. Because it's like they ran into it, like, and it, like,
oops,
ducked under the water and swam off.
Ooh.
So,
ow.
Yeah.
Hope it's okay.
And then also, what is a cryptid story without a cameo from our favorite slave-driving circus leader, P.T. Barnum?
Of course.
He's like,
oh, that guy.
He's like the like Zach Baggins of cryptids. You know, because Zach Baggins pops up in, like, every ghost story.
It's
ever.
True.
He's
it's
always
true.
Buying some piece of ghost merchandise or buying some haunted house, you know, or buying Robert the doll, you know. So it's like P.T. Barnum is the Zach Baggins of cryptids.
Exactly. I like it. In fact,
I think that's going to be part of the title. The Zach Baggins of cryptids.
It's settled.
In 1973, he offered a $50,000 reward, which in today's money is $1,059,090 in today's money. He offered that much of a reward for the hide of Great Champlain Serpent to add to my mammoth World's Fair show.
Whoa.
Yeah. So he was like, dead or alive,
like,
I'll give you $50,000.
Gimme
for, like, this creature to put it in my circus.
So,
to go alongside, you know, his mermaid and all the, you know, freaks that he exploited. So, wonderful person. Let's make a musical about him.
Yes.
Trademark.
Greatest show.
Trademark that.
Greatest show.
In 1945, so we are jumping ahead like 100 years, almost 100 years. Passengers of the SS Ticonderoga all saw a creature swimming around the middle of the lake. That is all I could find about that sighting. But once again, it was an entire boat full of people. So this is literally three boatloads of people over the past like 200 years have seen this creature.
Like there's something living in there.
Right? Summer of 1977 is when we got the most famous photograph of Champ to date. It's known as the Mansi photo. Amateur photographer, come on, Sammy, gee whiz, come on, say words. Amateur photographer Sandra Mansi was on vacation with her family when she snapped what is now the most famous photo of Champ. She saw some turbulence in the water and asked her fiance to grab the Instamatic camera, thinking she'd get a picture of her kids and some like big fish, because there are some big fish in that lake, like sturgeon and gar and other fish like that.
Big fish.
So real big fish, like the band. So she goes to take the picture and suddenly a large head and neck rose out of the water. Her fiance starts screaming for the kids to get out of the water. And she quickly snapped a picture of the creature before it disappeared back under the water.
That was lucky. I don't think I would have thought to do that.
Well, she already had the camera.
Yeah, but still, I'd be frozen. Like, holy cow.
Apparently, she was already, like, you know, in position, ready to go, like, and was just like,
click.
Click. So,
did I get that?
Yeah, I guess. So whether the photo actually shows Champ or not, though, is still up for debate, but is generally agreed upon, though, that the photo is undoctored and does show something. You know, like, specialists and photographers, like, all sorts of specialists have actually looked at it and they don't know. They have theories about what it might be, but for most of them, they're just plain and simple. The photo is at least not doctored, so it's not photoshopped. Scientists, though, have stated that the area that the photo was taken in is only about 14 feet deep, and they said that it's unlikely that a giant creature could swim, let alone hide in such shallow water. And then some people think that the creature in the photo is nothing more than a rising piece of driftwood. So, but I mean, the creature that she described seeing was only about 20 feet long. So, I mean, it's possible that it could somewhat swim in 14 foot water. It's 20 feet
even
long,
it,
but not like, necessarily huge.
Snaked around on the bottom, like used its belly to push itself up out of the water.
We don't know
what the heck
are
you doing? And then take
back
off.
We don't know how these things move. They're dinosaurs.
We don't know what they are.
We don't know what they are.
So how can you tell me how it behaves?
Right. So I'm going to show you pictures of the Mansi photo.
Ooh.
On the left here. And then on the right is kind of like a model of what the driftwood could have looked like.
Interesting.
Or what they assume the driftwood could have looked like. But on the left is the picture that's known as the Mansi photo.
Oh, wow.
It's creepy looking.
I can see how that could be driftwood, but I can see how that could be a head and neck, too. That's bizarre.
Yeah.
Huh.
So, I think the picture is... it's like on display in like a museum or something like that, because they like scientists were like, despite the fact that we're not sure what it is, it's still an important part of this lake's history. So we're still going to put it on display. And also to go with that driftwood theory, actually, I'll go more into that in the theory section. So just remind me, otherwise I might forget because I don't think I wrote it down.
Okay.
I should have wrote that down.
You should have.
On July,
you should look that up.
I should look that up. Well, I did look it up. I just didn't write it down.
Well, progress.
Progress.
The point is progress.
The point is progress. So, on July 30th of 1984, was the largest mass sighting of Champ to date. Around 6 p.m., between 70 and 86 passengers aboard the Spirit of Ethan Allen saw a creature for the duration of about 3 whole minutes.
Whoa.
So like 86 people on this boat saw this creature.
Like saw it. Like and a half minutes is a long time.
Yeah. 3 to 5 greenish brown humps rose and fell about 12 inches out of the water. So it was like undulating in and out of the water.
Wow.
Judging from the size and spacing of the humps, they estimated the creature to be about 30 feet long. It swam alongside the boat for about 1,000 yards before a speedboat came along. So it wasn't like it was stationary. It was moving with the boat for 1,000 yards. That's a long distance.
Yeah.
So then a speedboat came along and scared it off, at which point it made a 90-degree turn and vanished.
Whoa.
That's not a rock. That's not a piece of driftwood.
No, that's like something that can propel itself. That's and something can make decisions.
That's
and...
something that can move. That's
Holy
something
cow.
Animate. And
that's
86
crazy.
People saw this for a duration of 3 minutes and 1,000 yards.
And for the record, guys, it's only been a minute since we last said 3 minutes. Like, we haven't even passed 3 minutes since we first started talking about this story.
Yeah.
So, like, they would still, we would still be looking at this thing.
Yeah.
That's
like,
insane.
I mean, it's like, if it was a flash of, like, something swimming past, you could kind of, like, write it off as, oh, you know, I just saw something or we just saw a log. But it's like 3 minutes is plenty of time to comprehend what you're seeing.
Yeah, I'm still looking at it right now. You know, I've still got about 90 seconds left.
Yeah, I mean, with 3 minutes, that's even enough time to consciously pull out a camera and take a picture of it. You know,
exactly.
It's like at that point, like the shock is probably worn off to the point where you would think to pull out a camera or something.
Like, I should probably document this. That's crazy.
Right?
And it was in the 80s, right?
Yeah,
so 84. There's like people are aware and there are cameras, like maybe not as like obviously as prevalent as they are now and stuff. But like people had camcorders. Dads had camcorders.
I mean, you know, what Polaroids were around even.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, there were definitely cameras then. But anyway, next sighting comes from the very next year, almost about a year later. It was June 30th instead of July 30th. June 30th of 1985, local carpenter Dennis Hill was in a boat with his daughter, son, and father-in-law when his daughter first spotted Champ about a mile offshore. So they were in a boat about a mile offshore and she saw it. My daughter yelled, "Dad, there's something out there," Hall said. I have filmed it for maybe 20 seconds. I can't prove it's Champ, but you can see it raise its neck and then lower it back into the water. He said the creature was about 30 feet long, but the neck was really thick. He said that he spent his whole life on or around the lake and that this was the third time that he's seen it. So he's seen it a couple of times, which,
wow.
Personally, as a like cryptid enthusiast, the more somebody has seen a cryptid, the less likely I am to believe them.
Yeah.
Because then
they're
it's
like, oh yeah, I see that thing all the time.
Well,
it's,
I mean,
like, oh.
He said that he'd seen it three times as of 1985. I saw like some interview with him from like 2000 something. And he says that he's seen it about 20 times by this point. And it's just like, sure you have, buddy. You
okay.
know, like other people live around that lake too, and they haven't seen it 20 times. And it's not like you're a fisherman, you're a carpenter. So it's not like you're living out on the lake, making your livelihood. You know, those people haven't seen it 20 times. What makes you so special?
If he's a carpenter, wouldn't he be making his livelihood?
Oh my God. How did you think of that so fast?
That was like impressive.
And it hurt at the same time. Like, I love puns. I make a lot of puns, but that was impressive.
Just zing right in there.
So anyway, so that, like I said, just seeing it 20 times in like the span of 20 years, just it really, to me, seems a little bit incredible and not in a good way.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It seems a little incredulous.
Yes. There you go.
There you go. The next sighting comes from 1993, and it's not really a sighting per se, but a Japanese research team searched the entire lake using sonar with 15 boats and a couple of helicopters. So they kind of like, drudged the lake sort of thing.
We're going to find it.
We're going to find you.
We're going to find you.
Their results came back stating that a large 20-foot-long creature had passed underneath them, but that was all that they had.
But just one. Interesting.
In 2003, a team doing research for the Discovery Channel picked up a high-pitched ticking and chirping sound like what a dolphin or whale makes during echolocation. However, no known creatures living in the lake are known to use echolocation, as it's primarily used by mammals. And like freshwater porpoises, for example, they can live in lakes like this and they use echolocation, but they don't live in this lake. There is nothing documented in this lake that uses echolocation.
I wonder what it was.
Right?
That's bizarre.
And the sounds were recorded in three different areas of the lake, including a recently discovered man-made channel buried in the deepest part of the lake in which species can live undetected.
Ooh.
It'd be very easy for them to live there undetected.
Interesting. And a man-made channel, so it's all like you know, it's nice and smoothed out and honed for them and stuff. And it must have been like when they filled the lake or interesting.
Or it gives it a place for the lake to drain to. Yeah.
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 Interesting. So they can hide in there. I mean, anything is possible, especially with these huge lakes. I am like,
oh, I know. We both talked about how we're terrified of lakes.
Yeah.
Okay. So in summer of 2005, fisherman Dick Affalter and his stepson Pete Baudette claim to have captured the creature on film.
Oh, Dick and Pete out there shooting film.
Dick and Pete. Fisherman, let's see. Close examination of the images may be interpreted either as a head and neck of a plesiosaur-like animal, and even an open mouth in one frame, and a closed mouth in another, or maybe a fish or eel, which eels do live in this lake. So it's
true.
That's possible too, and eels can also get really big. Although two retired FBI forensic image analysts reviewed the tape, said that it appears authentic and unmanipulated. One of them added, there's no place in there that I can actually see an animal or any other object on the surface. So it's been studied by FBI forensic analysts, and they said it doesn't look doctored, you know, or manipulated. One of them specifically was like, I don't see anything.
Like, I don't know.
And then the most recent sighting or something similar to a sighting I have is from July 31st of 2014. Now, there have been other sightings since 2014, but they weren't documented. I couldn't find them anywhere. It was just like, there have been sightings up like as recent as 2018. Okay, well, what are they? Tell me, please.
Yeah.
But they didn't.
Show me the posts.
Show me the money. So anyway, so monster hunters electronically captured loud, deep sounds in a region called the Scotch Bonnet. So there's a region of, like, I guess different regions of the lake have different names or something. I didn't know that this was a common practice, I guess.
Oh, even at Folsom Lake, we've got, like, Brown's Ravine. I think it's usually kind of off of, like, whatever, like, marina's right there. So there's, like, a little kind of, like, cove, I guess. But, okay.
Well, I did not know this. But anyway, so there's a region of Lake Champlain known as the Scotch Bonnet. And they captured a loud, deep sound. And it's some of the most compelling scientific evidence to date of the unknown aquatic animal. And I actually have that sound for you guys here. So hang on. Did you hear that?
Yeah, it kind of sounded like water lapping.
Well, there was water lapping, and then there was like a little sound underneath it.
Like underneath it. Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Super creepy.
That's bizarre.
I love it, but... also, I have some fun facts this time as well before I get into the theories of what this could be. In 1981, Port Henry, New York declared their waters a safe haven for Champ. Basically saying that, you know, you're not allowed to hunt for him. He's safe here. You're not allowed to kill him.
So they're like, we don't really know what's in this thing, but there's a possibility. It's like, please don't kill it.
Yeah. It's basically protected wildlife.
Cool.
In 1982, the state of Vermont passed a House resolution protecting Champ.
Oh, wow.
And then in 1983, both the Assembly and State Senate for New York passed resolutions protecting Champ as well. So it started out just one port city, and then the state of Vermont and then the state of New York both passed laws protecting Champ, saying you can't hunt him. He's safe.
Interesting.
Here. We don't know if he's real or not, but if he is, he's a protected species, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, because we don't want to find out later, like, oh, hey, I killed Champ. Like, oh my God.
This endangered species.
We could have studied that. We could have found out where the heck that thing was living.
Yeah. I thought that was really cool. I think it's the only protected cryptid that I know of where it's like not just acknowledged. Now there are some states that have like the cryptid is their state mascot or something that, but this is the first cryptid I've ever come across that is literally protected by state law, you know, saying that like the state acknowledges that this creature may actually exist, and they have placards up around the lake saying you're not allowed to hunt Champ.
That's very interesting.
I was like, that is so cool.
Yeah.
So, okay. So anyway, getting into some explanations of what Champ might be, a species of pike, a gar pike or a long nose gar, which
those things are like,
Which pikes gars and sturgeons can all get to 20 or 30 feet long.
Gars
easily.
Are scary. Holy cow.
Oh, yeah. I have a picture of a long-nosed gar. Hang on. I will share that with you as well because it's really neat looking.
Woo-hoo.
So that is a long-nosed gar.
Prehistoric. Wow.
It does look kind of prehistoric. Like, there's actually a prehistoric, like, almost dolphin-like creature called an ichthyosaur that kind of looks like that. So other explanations are that it's floating logs, which, okay, yes, so I did kind of write this down, but not in depth. So logs, while they're decaying at the bottom of, like, rivers, lakes, oceans, stuff like that, the decaying of the wood actually releases gases inside the wood that can cause it to rise up to the surface at explosive speeds and actually make them look like they're breaching or that necks are rising up out of the water when it's actually roots and stuff like that.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, it's the decomposition process of the wood is releasing gases that are lighter than water and cause it to rise up exponentially fast.
I didn't know that. That's
I didn't either. I thought that was really cool. And actually makes a lot of sense for what some of these cryptids might be, which on one hand is kind of sad, but on the other hand, it's kind of neat because science is fascinating.
It is. It sure is. That's really cool. Interesting.
Another explanation is that it is a school of sturgeon diving in a row because when sturgeon go on like mating paths, they travel in single file almost. Like they don't travel in big school puddles like you know other fish do. They travel almost single file
in a line
and they will be diving one after the other single file, and it can create the illusion of humps rising up and down in the water. Flocks of blackbirds flying close to the water could also give the appearance of humps undulating on the water.
True.
And then we get into more of, you know, my favorite more archaeological explanations is that they are extinct dinosaurs such as like mosasaurs, bacillosaurs, like we mentioned with Nessie, which is like a prehistoric kind of whale, plesiosaurs, which can include subspecies like elasmosaur, which plesiosaur had a smaller neck and elasmosaurs could have necks up to like 30 feet long.
Wow.
And then another one is a Tanistropheus, which is this little, it's got like a lizard body, but a really long neck. And they could
that
apparently,
is bizarre.
They could apparently grow up to 2 or 3 feet long.
Really?
And then in some cases, like 10 feet long. But
those are crazy.
But
those
they were
guys,
also,
those are so weird. Yeah. I can't imagine seeing those things like still today, just floating around in my local lakes.
And apparently these ones were semi-aquatic, which Champ is actually known to sometimes come out on land.
Weird.
So some people think maybe it's this because this was a semi-aquatic prehistoric creature. But yeah, so that's all I have about Champ. I didn't know a lot about him prior to this research. Like I knew of him and I knew some stuff about him. At one point my dad was even like on a temporary duty assignment at a base that was right near Lake Champlain and heard stories about it as well.
Cool.
Once again, my dad comes into my cryptids.
Once again.
but yeah, so it's like I'd heard about it from my dad. And like, I think my parents told me about it because it was it's considered the American Loch Ness Monster, you know, the American Nessie. So it was just, I knew some things about it, but it was really cool to actually do some research and learn so much more about it. So
that's cool. And then to find out that it's a protected species. That's really cool. That that even the state has gone like, there might be onto something here.
Yeah. So just with the sheer amount of sightings and documented like proof that it might actually exist, it's one of the more well documented cryptids that actually has some grounding in reality as maybe it's real.
Interesting.
So I like it.
Very cool. Very cool. I learned something today. That's very cool. I'd never heard of that. That's very neat.
Yeah.
Well, very cool. So we are headed into a break now.
Yep.
When we come back, we're going to talk about my conspiracy. And sit tight, guys. We'll be right back.
Okay. We'll be back.
So, hey, before I get started, I wanted to say a special shout out.
Ooh.
To our new friends. We love hearing from you viewers out in the wild, and we caught a wild one. There was a couple that contacted us They were on a little road trip around like North Carolina and stuff. And they said they just like randomly discovered us and listened to us the whole time. So we want to say thank you for listening. And please tell your friends about us and everybody. Like,
at first I was like, where are you going with this? Who contacted us? And then you were like, and then I remembered. But you know, I'm very scatterbrained. But yes, I forgot entirely about that. But yeah, we had like some people like reach out and they were like, we just like, we're bored on the road on like a, what was it, like a 12-hour trip or something like that.
And they left us very nice messages. And
yeah,
like,
they were super sweet. And they were just like, oh, we were looking for something about cryptids and this popped up and we binged the entire, like, every episode we had out.
I know, exactly.
I was like, I've never had somebody binge us before. That's so awesome.
So thank you. Thanks for listening. I hope you continue. And I hope you guys had a really safe trip. So let's talk about some conspiracies, shall we?
Yes, we shall.
All right. So this one was music to my ears.
Okay.
We're talking about harps today.
Like the instrument?
H-A-A-R-P, actually not like the instrument. And no, that doesn't sound for the house of already angry retired persons. And nor does it indicate the hall of anxious, argyled role players.
Okay.
Nor does it refer to the home for angsty auto repair pandas.
Oh, God. Okay. What else do you have? Or is that the last one?
That's the last one I thought. I was driving home thinking of these. No, actually, it stands for the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. And it has long been the center of wild speculation about what it's actually supposed to do. Bands have been named after it. Books have been written. In fact, the conspiracy theories around it have become so prevalent, the program was shut down.
Oh.
Like, this is crazy. So let's begin.
Okay. Yes. I'm excited. I don't know anything about this.
The HARP machine is hidden in the mountains nearly 250 miles south of Fairbanks, Alaska. Construction started in 1993, but it wasn't fully operational in its current form until 2007 and ran until about May of 2013, kind of 2014. It kind of petered out because basically nobody wanted responsibility for it in the end.
Okay.
As of 2015, the U.S. Air Force officially has ownership of the facility, though.
Because of course we do. Okay.
Of course. So it was part of a larger research program designed to analyze the ionosphere, a portion of the upper atmosphere that stretches from about 53 miles above where we're sitting to about 370 miles up. And for like people here in California, that's about Sacramento to Santa Barbara, but like straight up. It's a 6-hour drive straight up.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The ionosphere is important because it plays a big role in transmitting radio signals, and it's always responding to influences from the sun. In fact, it's where our aurora borealis comes from, which is actually going to come back into the story in a little bit.
Okay.
Solar flares, though, can send particles, like sun particles, racing toward Earth, occasionally disrupting communications in the electrical grid. That's why we'll hear sometimes like, oh, there's been a solar flare, like our phones are going to be a little fussy for a little bit.
Right, right. We haven't had one of those in a while.
We haven't. And the point of HARP, though, was to better understand what happens inside the ionosphere and to better mitigate some of the communication issues within, like, the event of a flare. They wanted to try to prevent that kind of thing from happening. But so many conspiracy theorists showed up. They were like, ah, okay, good God, guys.
Oh, God. Let me guess. People thought that they were controlling the weather.
Oh, that's one thing they thought they were doing.
You know, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I've had interactions with people out in the wild that that when they find out I'm in the Air Force, literally the first thing they start talking to me about is, oh, you guys control the weather.
Great.
And it's like,
thanks.
Oh my God. Like, I think I've had three or four interactions total where it's like, I was in a train station. Oh, what do you do? Oh, I'm in the Air Force. Oh, well, you guys control the weather. And then they also said that we control the weather with chemtrails. And I was like, wow, this is a double-edged sword that you're wielding. You need to calm down. You're going to poke somebody's eye out with that.
You're going to cut a finger off. Like, holy cow.
And then there was a guy here down at one of the piers that said that he used to work at this base that I'm at. As a weather controller, and that he used to be one of the people controlling the weather. And I was like, oh buddy, there is so much meth in this area. And I'm pretty sure
it's your fault. There he is. Get him.
There is so much meth around here. Like, just like there is around Sacramento, just so much meth. And it's like, those kind of people are everywhere.
Just so much meth.
So much meth.
Well, Harp itself is a little spooky. It's actually, it's made up of 180 massive antennas sprawled over 33 acres. And I've got a picture here for you. Ooh, it's like, it looks like a like big electrical field with like these like weird, almost like clotheslines. Like, you know, those old like spinny clotheslines that you can like.
Yeah. Yeah. The ones that kind of look like a god's eye.
Yeah, like, see, like this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, I see.
Okay, and it's like kind of like it's like fenced in, but it's in the middle of Alaska, right?
Right.
The science behind it involves a whole bunch of lingo that may be a little cross-eyed, but all you guys need to know is that the HARP sent radio beams into the ionosphere to study the responses from it. One of the few ways to actually study it, because we can't really, like, we can get up there, obviously, but it's like, it's a very thin layer, so it's better just to send radio signals up there and go, what's going on? Kind of like echolocation.
Right, right, right.
It was outfitted with a high-power radio frequency transmitter that can reach a small portion of the layer to tickle that corner of the atmosphere, and then other instruments on the ground measure those disturbances here.
Okay.
It was funded by the Air Force, the Navy, the University of Alaska, and the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, as we've definitely mentioned on this pod before. Oh, so it sounds like a recipe for a juicy conspiracy if I've ever seen one. If there's a conspiracy, DARPA's behind it.
Right, right.
The HARP cost more than $290 million to build, much of it set aside by late Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska. Stevens helped win approval for $250 million for the facility and its construction after a big push for it starting in 1990. So it actually ended up being completed about $40 million over budget. So, and it took a very long time, because if you remember, the interest started in it for it at about like 1990. It's, the construction started by 1993, and then it wasn't operational until what, 14 years later, 2007.
Oh boy.
Oh, so it took a really long time to build this.
And then it was only operational for another 14 years or another 7 years. And then they shut it down
before they were like, okay, enough. All right.
Wow. What a big waste of money.
Yeah.
No wonder we're in debt.
Right. The ultimate goal was to improve methods for submarine communication and improve the ability to remotely sense and map mineral content of the terrestrial subsurface and underground complexes of regions or countries. So they're like trying to using the atmosphere to map what's underneath the ground, because you bounce it off the thing and it comes back to the thing. And, the, you know, like I said, science that makes me cross-eyed. Right. But I'm not going to try to explain it to you guys, because I just sound like a bigger idiot. But right now, the facility doesn't reach as far as the Middle East, but some of the researchers involved say that mobility is possible. So this thing could, like, become a little ice cream truck just sending out its little beep, 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 beep.
So it has the potential to be mobile, but it's not, like, it's not practical, basically.
Exactly. Gotcha. Exactly. So, all right, you guys ready for some sexy science talk that I don't fully understand?
Okay. Me either. Yeah, I'm ready. Where's your bow tie? Be sexy Bill Nye.
Sexy Bill Nye. Okay, so other research at the HARP included plasma line observations.
I have no idea.
Stimulated electron emission observations. Gyro frequency heating research. Oh,
I love that gyro frequency heating research.
Oh my. Oh, here's one. Oh. Spread F observations. Like, steamy. Also, air glow observations, radio observations of meteors. Hey, I understand that word. underground imaging, producing of high-density plasma clouds in the Earth's upper atmosphere. Hey, maybe don't do that. That doesn't sound like that sounds a little like maybe, hey, don't do that.
Yeah, maybe let's not. Maybe don't do that.
And then there's like a whole bunch of other stuff that I, you know, but that's what I can pronounce it without embarrassing myself. So. They did a lot. They did a lot of stuff. But this was also really cool, too. And I actually remember this happening. In March of 2004, the HARP was used to shoot intense radio beams into the night sky, creating a modest neon light show visible from the ground. This was Earth's first artificially created aurora. So we made our own aurora borealis.
I don't remember that.
So, but we did it with this thing up in Alaska. there's not a lot of information publicly available on how they did this, but what is available, I don't like fully understand. I won't pretend to. But scientists speculated the process could be used to light an entire city or generate celestial advertisements in the future. Something that I know China has actually looked into, which we're going to talk about in a second. But first, I'm going to show you the artificial Borealis.
celestial advertisements. I'm just thinking of basically like giant holograms in the sky. And that's how they're going to advertise like got milk written like in the clouds. Yes, yes, basically like a billboard in the sky,
just orbiting, just going around, you know. But this is what the Borealis originally looked like, and like, you know, kind of cool, kind of neat.
That
here
is really interesting.
But speaking of the advertisement, though, in 2018, the launch company Rocket Lab sent a shiny object it dubbed the Humanity Star, a 3-foot-wide disco ball, into orbit. This happened last year.
Ooh, okay.
Its reflective surface would shine down on us, visible to the naked eye for a few months. And this is kind of considered the inception of space billboards, because you'd be able to see if the satellite was coming over, you'd be able to see this like weird little shiny light coming through, and you would know, oh, that's the Humanity Star. And you would know what company like put that up there, what, you know, what they were advertising and stuff. So it was kind of that first dipping the toe in the water of that kind of advertisement. I mean, could you imagine like we like go out to like the arena
really
and
that.
You have like this weird like screen just across the atmosphere that you can't get rid of?
I don't want that. I really don't want that.
I
that
don't
sounds
either.
Really freaking terrible, where it's like we just, instead of seeing the beautiful blue sky and the clouds and the stars and stuff like that, you see yet more advertisement, more
Nike,
ad placement.
Nike, Adidas,
Nike,
like, buy an iPhone.
Just do it.
You know,
how about Nike? Just don't.
Just don't. Just don't. Don't.
Just don't.
Don't.
That, I mean, honestly, like that, the thought of that actually really makes me angry.
Right? Doesn't it? It's like I don't need that kind of advertisement. I don't.
We've polluted the ground and the water enough. Do we really need to, and the air, do we really need to pollute the atmosphere with
the light
advertisements?
You know, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh. And, it's interesting. Producer Ian and I were talking the other day about how we as a generation were even, I mean, I'm sure it was taught to us as an introduction and kind of an explanation of like, hey, you know, if you're interested in advertising, this is how it's done. But it really kind of showed us, this is what advertising is. This is what they're doing. This is how they're doing it. This is how they're getting their attention. This is how they're manipulating you.
Yeah,
this
absolutely. Is,
so I feel like we got that, you know, one of those early educations into, you know, identifying what we're being sold, why we're being sold and stuff. So when we see advertisements in something like this, it's like, okay, enough.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't,
we already
want...
have to click through two ads on YouTube, like already at this point to get to what we want to watch. Like,
this is literally a pop-up in the sky.
In the sky that you can't X
that
out.
You can't X out of. You can't skip to watch your YouTube video about conspiracy theories. It's literally just sit there and stare, instead of, once again, looking at the stars, the constellations, the beauty of the galaxy and universe beyond our own planet, we have to look at Just Do It.
Could you imagine if they had sound, too? Like, if your phone could tell when the satellite's nearby, and as
and
it passes
just
by,
and it just immediately starts playing from your phone, or starts playing from every smart TV and Amazon Echo that's around, you know, just starts blasting the advertisement.
Because it's nearby.
I'm literally angry right now.
Hundreds of times a day. I know.
I am so mad right now just thinking about this. If this ever becomes a thing, like, what do we even do to stop this?
We become mole people. That's why, maybe that's why people went underground to begin with. All the satellites fell out of the sky. They all deteriorated. And then we started all over again.
The
and everyone's like, where did these people
the
come from?
Mole people.
Exactly.
Yes.
So
I'll become a mole people. I'll grow gills and go live in the water with Nessie and Champ if it means that I can get away from sky ads.
Exactly. So Now that we've talked about sky ads.
Okay, yeah, please. Something that doesn't make me so angry.
The pod is definitely about conspiracies, right? So we need to. And I've mentioned the conspiracies became so prevalent around this that it just completely fell apart. Right. So, of course, despite being made it open and publicly logged from the start in an attempt at complete transparency, they were like, this is what we're doing here. This is what we're building. This is how it. This is the technology. Like,
right.
You can't tell us that we're being secretive here. We're telling you guys we're shooting radio signals up into the ionosphere. Of course, conspiracy theorists think that the HAARP was much more sinister than it was.
Right, of course.
In 1996, Rosalie Bertell warned about the deployment of HAARP as a military weapon. Now, she's actually someone kind of, like, of note to have a problem with this program. Bertell was an American scientist, author, environmental activist, epidemiologist, and a Catholic nun. She's best known for her work in the field of ionizing radiation. In fact, in 1986, she was awarded the Right Livelihood Award for, quote, raising public awareness about the destruction of the biosphere and the human gene pool, especially by low-level radiation. She did a lot with the military. She did a lot with the government. And then suddenly she pops up in 96, 3 years after construction started, and goes, there's a problem here. And they were like, meh, like, meh. Nothing ever really came of it, obviously. They went forward with it.
Right. I feel like for her to speak out against it kind of adds some validity to that claim, right? Especially with her background.
Yeah.
You know, she's
like, she's a scientist.
Yeah.
Like, that, I was like, wow, you're like, she's like a full-on scientist. She passed away in 2012, and she lived a very long time, but she was very, very forward-thinking in her field. Mm-hmm. And a nun, I thought, was also kind of cool.
Yeah, it is kind of neat.
Then Michelle Chusadovsky stated in a book published by the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform that, quote, recent scientific evidence suggests that HAARP is fully operational and has the capability of triggering floods, hurricanes, droughts, and earthquakes.
Okay, yeah, weather control. There we
weather
go.
Weather control. Yep. Yep. Exactly.
I knew it was coming.
Exactly. They also think it's responsible for global warming and controlling the weather. Like we said, it's been blamed for the Moore, Oklahoma tornado of 2013. It was blamed for the Philippines landslide in 2006.
Oh, yeah. That was devastating.
Other natural disasters like the earthquake in Japan. Mm-hmm. In 2008, the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan. In fact, when that tsunami happened, I actually found another article. I found another conspiracy about what that was, and it may have been a nuclear detonation
underwater.
Water that then sucked all the... that'll be probably another one I cover eventually and stuff, because I know a lot of people did die in that and stuff, but I thought that was interesting, the possibility.
I feel like I heard that conspiracy, that it was like an underwater explosion caused the tsunami. Yeah.
So yeah.
I feel like I've heard that.
In 2010, Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez claimed that HAARP or a program like it triggered the earthquake in Haiti. Mm-hmm. This is not true. It was due to a previously unmapped fault line that was found when it suddenly slipped, killing 230,000 people.
That was bad.
I was, oh my God, oh man, nuts. When I was, in fact, I feel bad, you know, obviously keeping that kind of dark statistic in there, but I was doing the research, obviously, and I was like, how many was that, hundreds or thousand? 230,000 people.
230,000 people. That's so many.
Oh man, that's wow. So, but we didn't know about that fault line, and all of a sudden it slips and it's like, oh whoa, there's a hole.
It never ceases to amaze me how much about our planet we still don't know.
Yeah,
you know, like, I mean, that fault has been there since the Earth's creation, and we just figured out about it, like, what, 3-4 years ago?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
It's like,
yeah, 10 years ago now,
oh, 10
or
years
almost
ago.
10 years ago, is 2010. Can you believe that?
Oh, my God.
Already 10 years ago.
It was just yesterday. But yeah, I mean, it's just nuts, though, how much we still don't know about our planet.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And we're always focused on going everywhere else, but we still don't know everything about this one.
Yeah.
So it's also been blamed for mysterious humming noises coming from the atmosphere, but I'm going to explain why that's not related when I get to my conclusion. There's also, it's been accused of mind control. Nick Begich Jr., son of the late U.S. Representative Nick Begich Sr., wrote a book on the topic called Angels Don't Play This HAARP. I love it. In it, he claims the HAARP facility could trigger earthquakes and turn the upper atmosphere into a giant lens so that the sky would literally appear to burn. He actually still maintains a website saying that HAARP is a mind control device to this day.
Oh, boy. Okay.
It doesn't even work anymore. It's all been shut down, but apparently. he's still paying for his GoDaddy account. Also, a Russian military journal said that ionospheric testing would trigger a cascade of electrons that would flip Earth's magnetic poles.
I remember hearing about that.
But I don't know who wrote it, what kind of scientist, you know, they were just some schmo with a pen and a book, or if it was a scientist, you know, it was just a Russian journal that somebody found. Even the Alaska State Legislature and the European Parliament held hearings about HAARP, the latter citing environmental concerns, but no one wants you messing with their ionosphere. Come on.
Right.
In 2012, pseudoscientist Richard Hoagland took his experiment to Mexico, where he reported that he had detected the HAARP was being used to prevent the planet from tipping over just before he was completely thrown out of the place. They were like, you're insane. The planet's not going to flip over. Go.
You're crazy.
even the former governor of Minnesota, ex-professional wrestler, documentarian Jesse Ventura, questioned whether the government is using the site to manipulate the weather to bombard people with mind-controlling radio waves. So even Jesse Ventura is in on it.
Oh, God.
But why did this shut down? So I've said before that all these conspiracy theories of people were like, we don't understand the science behind this, so there must be something bad going on here. Because we can't read more than 30 seconds.
If we can't explain it, it's got to be bad.
It's got to be bad. So the HAARP program was also was so often called completely worthless because it costs a lot more than its initial budget. And since most of the resorts weren't even tangible, it's easy to stomp your feet and claim it doesn't work. Mm. In May of 2013, the site shut down during a change in operations contractors. At the time, the HAARP program manager told reporters that the site was temporarily closed and locked with only one DARPA project left to wrap up by the following year.
Okay.
Then again, it kind of changed hands a couple of times, and the bureau was like, you take it. No, you take it. No, you take it. No, you take it. By May of the following year, at a Senate hearing, the Air Force Deputy Assistant Secretary for Science, Technology, and Engineering, David Walker, said that the Air Force had no interest in maintaining the site and is moving in another direction in ionospheric research, and the program was shut down.
And it's just sitting there, I'm assuming.
Yes. Well, actually, they eventually, I'll come back to kind of what it does now. You can actually still go visit it, technically,
okay,
on like a smaller scale. But two men were arrested on drug charges in November of 2016. They were reportedly plotting a domestic terrorism plan based on conspiracy theories around HAARP. They were found with a massive arsenal that included AR-15 rifles, handguns, a Remington rifle, and thousands of rounds of ammunition. Police say the men confessed that, quote, God told them to go and blow this machine up that kept souls so souls could be released. Yeah. Hi, Georgia. How you doing?
Oh, I'm so concerned.
Oh.
These people had access to that many guns. I am so concerned.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Okay. Yep.
So there's also, you know, so they say mind control, weather control, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
There's really nothing we can do to disturb the Earth's weather patterns except, you know, be a better human being and do good things for the environment, guys. Like, pick up after yourself. You know. Common sense.
Right.
But on this scale, even though the power HAARP radiates is very large, it's totally minuscule compared to the trauma of a lightning flash. And there are 50 to 100 lightning flashes every second. So HAARP's intensity compared to that is very, very small. So people that are like, you're affecting the ionosphere. It's like, no, these cracks of lightning like rip apart the sky. And this just sends out like, it's like you know, when you like do the UV light on your teeth when you're whitening and it's just
right,
like, boop, boop,
right,
boop, 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 like that kind of
pulsates.
Like,
like a tiny little.
Yeah, it's just
pulsates.
Little gamma rays, like, right.
Where lightning literally like tears.
Yeah. Like
the
rips the air apart. Like,
yes.
Crazy. And then computer scientist David Nadich says HAARP is just a magnet for conspiracy theorists because its purpose is just deeply mysterious to the scientifically uninformed. They're just like, I don't know. Ionosphere. We have an atmosphere. Thank you very much. And it's like there's layers here. There's a lot of science that you don't have
ionosphere,
to know about.
Iona, know what you talking about. That one wasn't as good as yours.
That's good. You tried. The point is you tried. So people can bang their pots and pans about this all they want, but the truth is the U.S. version of the HAARP isn't even unique. Finland has Kyra, Lofar in the Netherlands, Icecat in Sweden, Norway and Finland, and the Super Darn. It's called the Super Darn Network. God. Super okay. Darn.
Super Darn.
Which consists of 35 radars all around the world, and nobody really seems to care about those.
Oh, no. Most people, they don't care about anything unless it's America doing it. And then it's like, oh, it must be bad because it's America. It's like, okay. And okay.
I wanted to take just a brief opportunity to talk to touch on the difference between fake news and the scientific theory. Because sometimes I'll see, like, and I may have mentioned this before on the pod, but I'll see things like, I saw an article that said that the solar road in the Netherlands was a complete failure. I wouldn't call it a failure because, I mean, it eventually disintegrated and it's been really hard to keep up. It doesn't generate the power that it was supposed to. But if you remember that the scientific theory is raising a hypothesis, conducting experiments to support your hypothesis. And even if your hypothesis doesn't come true, your scientific theory still worked because you found out whether or not it was true.
Yeah.
So
it still taught us something. We still learned something from it. So it's like, yes, it may have been the end result may not have been a success, but everything leading up to that failure still taught us something and was still a win. It may not have been the win we were hoping for, but we still, either way, we ultimately win because we gain knowledge either way.
Exactly. So I want you guys to take that with you moving forward. I want you guys to remember that when you read articles that things may not necessarily, because sometimes they're written like that, like it's a complete failure. Like, that's not entirely. We still learned a lot of really, really, really good information from it.
Right.
So they tried really hard to keep it alive, keep the facility alive, and squash the conspiracy theories. In fact, in August of 2014, the HARP facility and antenna array was open to the public, complete with guided tours and lectures to try to better educate the public. Educate.
Oh, we're having trouble.
We are. It's late. Educate the public about what they were doing. While the experiments officially ended in 2014, the complete shutdown and dismantling of the facility was postponed until at least May of the following year. And then by mid-August of 2015, control of the facility and its equipment were turned over entirely to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which offers the facilities on a pay-per-use basis. So it does technically still exist. You can still use it for experiments. They will let you, you know, if you're a scientist, come up
but
there
you
and
have
see
to,
it.
You have to petition the University of Fairbanks.
Exactly.
Okay.
But as far That's as cool. my research, like the University of Fairbanks has it, but the Air Force still technically owns it.
Gotcha. So they've just kind of like granted authorization to the university to kind of basically like delegated it down. Like, yes, we still own it, but you're the ones that are authorized to let people in or not.
And I believe the university originally had some of the funding put in it, like in the initial construction of it.
Right,
so they
right.
may have already had also kind of a claim to like, hey, I will take this if nobody wants it because it's a university. Why would you not want something like that? It's scientific theory, guys.
Right. You know, so it's something. Yeah. Well, and the way I see it, it's like by allowing the university to operate it and run it, it makes it so that the Air Force doesn't have to spend money keeping it up. And it also, like, it's a win-win situation for the Air Force and for the university because, like I said, the Air Force doesn't have to spend money operating it and keeping it up to date and authorizing people to go in. And the university can make money to, you know, better fund other programs in their science program and stuff like that. So it probably works out, you know, mutually for both parties.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope so. So that's the HARP machine.
That's really cool. I didn't really know about that. I don't even remember the simulated Aurora Borealis. I don't remember that at all.
I was reminded when I was reading the article. I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. We did do that. That's so crazy. Humans are cool. Hey, guys, good on ya. You're cool.
We're cool. Like,
we're cool.
We're creepy sometimes, but we're pretty cool, too.
We're pretty cool. You know. So thank you guys so much for listening. Let's see. We're coming up. We've got just a couple more episodes in the season left.
Because, you know, we take like a holiday season hiatus for those of you who, you know, are catching up or are listening from new back to old. I don't know how people listen.
Yeah.
So we've got this episode that comes out. Well, today's the 1st of November if you're listening now. We've got November 15th. And then we will be on a bit of a break. We won't have a December 1st episode. But we will have a December 15th episode, which will be kind of like our Christmas episode sort of thing. Yeah. I don't know. Should I release that on the 15th or on December 25th?
We do the 15th because yeah, people we are probably do the doing 15th. Stuff on Christmas. So.
But that episode will actually be kind of special because I'm actually flying home to California for the Christmas season.
We'll be so together again.
Tess and I will actually be recording in the same room yes. for the first time since April. So that'll be really cool. And then that'll be the last episode of season three. I don't think we'll be back again until January 15th.
I think so. And that's I think what that's we what we
did
do.
Last year. Yeah. Yeah, it was January 15th. So, yeah. So basically, the 15th of this month, you'll get an episode. You'll wait a month. You get one December 15th. Wait another month and you'll get January 15th. So. And then we'll be back on our regular scheduled programming.
You guys will have to wait a little bit, but we got families too and stuff.
We've got families. Yeah, no. We need breaks and vacations too.
Exactly. So we love you guys for listening. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay weird. Stay curious. You know, keep asking questions. Keep calling your senators, you know. Make a ruckus.
make some noise. But and don't forget, Big Brother is watching.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Conspiracies and Cryptids with Sammy and Tessa. Don't forget to check out our website, www.conspiriesandcryptids.com, for more episodes and other information.
And if you're really enjoying what we're doing, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/cryptipod. That's CRYPTIPOD. There you can find different ways to support us and get some awesome goodies along the way.
While you're at it, you can also find us on all of your favorite social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's any one of those at Cryptipod.
And if you're enjoying our podcast, please think about leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. Leave us 5 stars and a nice little blurb about why you like us. It helps us to gain some traction and find some new listeners.
And while you're at it, don't forget to tell your friends, because our friends are your friends.
And don't forget, Big Brother is watching.